Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. This week, Three's Company, with your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra offering up a trio of works, including a world premiere and three fabulous guests. We have with us RPO Music Director Ward Steer. Welcome, Ward.
Thank you.
And we have with us harpist Yolanda Konanassis. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Pulitzer Prize and Grammy Award winning composer Jennifer Higdon. It's great to have you here.
Good to be here.
It's nice to have the whole batch of you there. Let's take a moment and talk about first the bees. You are opening this show with the 4C interludes from Peter Grimes. These are magical pieces, each and every one of them.
They really are. The opera, of course, is one of the masterpieces in the repertoire. It's just stunning. It's so poignant, powerful, beautiful, but in a disturbing way that, you know, it's just, it sends chills, you know, every time you hear it or experience it. And the 4C interludes are really very important elements to the drama as the opera unfolds. They're taken from various points, you know, throughout the progression of the story. They're not in the same order in the suite, but they offer a tremendous variety. We have we have dawn, we have Sunday morning, we have moonlight, and then of course the storm. And it's only about 17 minutes all told, but in that 17 minutes, you go on quite a journey.
It's an amazing journey. He actually pulled these out of the opera before the opera even
mm-hmm.
premiered.
Right, right. A lot of composers do that or have done that, I think, historically. They just sort of want to trot out little excerpts, you know, before the complete mm-hmm. piece is done. And I think it works great as a concert piece, even if you don't know the context. And if you know the context, it's even more powerful.
Well, Britten wrote these marginal notes on the early drafts of the libretto, and I love them. For Dawn, he simply wrote, "Everyday Gray Seascape," which is, well, talk about that a little.
Well, Dawn, I don't know. It's hard for me to pick a favorite movement of these four, but the thing I love about the Dawn music is that it's got a lot of mystery. It's got that eerie sort of electricity in the air that you feel, you know, as the sun rises on the coast, and you get the promise of the day, but you also have sort of, you know, a little bit of the hangover of the night and the mystery. And whenever I hear this piece and whenever I conduct it, I always try to remember that the sea is beautiful, the sea is mysterious, but the sea is also dangerous. And there's an element of danger in the music. In this very ethereal line that starts in the violins and the flute and just sort of floats there. But every now and then you get a little stab, a little accent stuck in there, which, you know, just gives you a hint that, okay, this is not, it's not all easy and peaceful. There's going to be some stuff going on here. The use of colors, the orchestration that Britten employs is, I think, stunning. And it's a really beautiful way to open this concert.
Now, I do know which of mine is the favorite. I do have a favorite. And it's only because it's the one that every single time stops me actually in my tracks, and that is Sunday morning. Sunny, sparkling music is what he called it.
Right. Well, there are very few moments actually in the opera where, you know, there's not some underlying tension. It's a very charged work. But this piece is just about trying to enjoy a beautiful Sunday morning. And you hear the bells tolling and you hear the townspeople sort of coming together. And it's got this sort of chattery atmosphere about it, very light, very joyful.
And then number three, Moonlight, Summer Night, Seascape, Quiet.
Mm, yeah, Moonlight is, it's so beautiful. And there's this great effect that he writes into the orchestra part. And it's funny because a little bit of trivia for you out there. He doesn't put all the instructions in the orchestra musician's parts. It's only in the conductor's score. So every time I conduct this, I have to explain it the way it's notated. It's interesting because he asks for a gentle swell on every single syncopated quarter note. So you get this bom, 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 this gentle pulse. And then he says, every now and then I'll put a hairpin in brackets, and that's where you do not swell. So it's counterintuitive. You know, the musicians, they look at that and they think this is where I put the swell, but it's actually the opposite. And so it's difficult to achieve that effect, not only because it's, you know, requires a lot of concentration and focus, but because it's counterintuitive the way it's written. But when you get it, it really makes you feel like you're sitting by the shore and it's a gentle lapping of the waves, you know, at low tide in the middle of the night or whatever. And it's so calm, it's so peaceful, it's almost hypnotic the way it gets you into this trance. And the colors in the orchestra, just to me, if you close your eyes, you see that, you know, deep blue with the full moon and the sea, and it's just, it's magic. It's just extraordinary.
And of course it ends, and we don't need a descriptor for this one, storm.
Right, well, yeah, the storm is, I mean, it's a tour de force for the entire orchestra, and the storm in the opera, of course, is, it's a metaphor for a lot of different things. I mean, the storm of things to come in the drama with Peter Grimes. The storm represents the angry townspeople. The storm represents his own inner turmoil. The storm, you know, represents, you know, the conflict between various characters. And of course, the storm also represents the storm, because there are deaths, you know, that happen out at sea in the course of the drama. And so it's an incredible tool, I think, and the way Britten puts everything together musically, it really packs a wallop.
Now, Britten wrote this at an interesting point in his life, because he left and did not fight in the war. He was a conscientious mm-hmm. objector, mm-hmm. and of course he was gay as well.
Mm-hmm.
So Britten came back to his beloved England after the war very much an outsider,
mm-hmm.
and one of the first things he did was to write an opera about an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
Was it an apology? Was an explanation?
I don't know. It's really tough to speculate about what his feelings were, but I do think that he was able to really get himself inside the character of Grimes on many different levels, emotionally and psychologically, and I think that's part of what gives it such power and makes the drama so effective.
Now, Under the Brahms, we go for his Symphony No. 2. Took him almost 2 decades to write Symphony No. 1. Took him less than a year just cranked out Symphony No. 2. On vacation. and how is that reflected in this symphony?
Well, of course, we all love the Brahms symphonies. I wish there were more than four of them, but there are only four, and each one is completely different in character. And I know we talked about this a little bit last year when we did the first symphony on the season. And the second symphony is definitely his sunniest. It's definitely his brightest. There are occasional moments of darkness, but they're fleeting. It's just like a cloud passing by the sun when you're out on a beautiful day walking around. I mean, it doesn't last. There's no sense of weight or oppression or, you know, heavy. There's no heavy heart in this piece. It's all about joy and beauty.
People have referred to this as his pastoral symphony. He must have hated that.
Well, yet another comparison with Beethoven,
exactly.
Right? Yeah, he always struggled to get out of his shadow. But I think if you look at the four symphonies and you look at what he was able to accomplish with the tremendous depth, range, and scope, you know, the second symphony definitely has a rightful place, you know, in the pantheon with all the other symphonies. And it's the most, I think, the most often performed, if you had to pick. Maybe four, but two and four are done a lot. But I never get sick of it. I always love it. It's such a beautiful piece.
And yet it didn't always get good reviews. Some, especially in Boston, they were pretty cranky. But in Boston, it said, it would appear as though Brahms might afford occasionally to put a little more melody into his work.
Oh, please. Come on. Give
what
me a break.
Really needed to put in there was a harp part.
Yeah.
It sabotaged all four of them without a harp part.
Well, it's, you know... Yes, it would have benefited from the harp, clearly. But no, I think it is melodic. It's beautiful. It's also the way he develops his themes and the way he develops the music. It's much more organic. It's just so easy flowing. And his, you know, the DNA, the musical DNA is there in the very beginning and it remains throughout. And it's just, I think it's masterful. He makes it sound light and easy. But, you know, as we all know, it takes a lot of work to make it look that easy.
You know, this was also a huge hit right out of the box. This one got, except for the cranks in Boston, this one got great reviews from the very start. And in fact, the first time it was played, this is the third movement, I believe, had to be played a second time.
Mm-hmm.
And it never stopped rolling along.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently Boston just needs to get with the plan.
I don't know. Must have been, the critic must have woken up on the wrong side of the bed that day. I don't know.
Is it just that it's so sunny that makes everybody love this so much?
I think so. And you know, you... it leaves you with a lot of, you know, earworms, and it's just, it's got this great, great energy and great atmosphere, and it ends in such glory and triumph, and it's just so rousing, the ending. It just, it's like he gets this big train moving, and it just kind of takes you right into the station. And wow, it's awesome. It's wonderful when you arrive at the end. Glorious.
Well, speaking of glorious, we have in between these two iconic works, a new piece. This time it's a harp concerto. It is by Jennifer Higdon. Yolanda Kananesis is going to be the soloist. I want to know how this happened. How did this come about, Jennifer?
That's a good question. Yolanda probably remembers. I think we started communicating about this at the very tail end of 2006 or early 2007. Mm-hmm. I think you sent me an email and said, can you write me a harp concerto? Would you be interested? And I looked at my schedule and I said, amazingly, I didn't have time to do it for a couple of years. But I didn't expect that it would take this long for me to get it into my schedule. I have a busy schedule. It's a great thing. But the nice thing about it being delayed, because most of my concertos, it does take quite a few years to get them on my schedule, is I learn with every concerto I write. This was my 14th that I've written. I think I learn with each one what needs to happen for this instrument, and I also wanted to absorb more about the harp in general. So all the pieces I was writing leading up to this tend to have quite a bit of harp in them, because in a certain sense I was learning more about the instrument so I could really feature it in a piece.
So why Jennifer Higdon?
Well, you know, it probably for me goes back to, oh gosh, this must have been maybe something close to 15 years ago. And I was playing the Ginastera, I believe, with the Oklahoma City Philharmonic. First on the program was Blue Cathedral. And I usually, you know, mosey on backstage and start, you know, hopping around and doing my, you know, my little ritual during the overture or the first piece on a program. And I was just completely struck by this. And, you know, the Oklahoma City Philharmonic, you know, is not, you know, generally, you know, because of the demographic and the location, is not an orchestra that programs a lot of newer music. And I was just entranced by it, standing back there. I, you know, in fact, I forgot to eat my M&Ms and, you know, do my usual jumping around. And the audience just went, like, bananas over this piece. And, you know, I felt the same way. And I thought, oh, my gosh, there's so much cool color and magic in this music. And I guess that was the first time I sort of locked into the idea that Jennifer would just do amazing things with the harp, because we need a new iconic harp concerto or two. You know, I've made my career as a soloist, but I find I play, you know, the same 4, 5, 6 concertos over and over and over. There are others. They just somehow haven't caught on, you know, in the way that, you know, we wish they would. And I just thought, you know, Jennifer's voice would be such a great fit for the harp. Because I, you know, I don't know if you would categorize your style like this, but I just really feel like Jennifer's got such spirit, but there's also a pretty strong thread of kind of magic in there. And that has something in common with the harp. I
do believe in magic and music. There's a part that you can't explain. And I love that, trying to capture that. It's like trying to capture it in a jar or something and pass it along to other people. Mm-hmm. And Blue Cathedral tends to be the piece that most people get to
the
know
gateway
my music
drug.
That's it, exactly. And even for orchestras that have never done any contemporary music, it's amazing how many people will call me and say, we want to rent this piece. We've never done this before, so you got to walk us through it. But I think that piece has now been done by something like 700 orchestras. I mean, there are two orchestras doing it this weekend. So, I mean, it's like it has like a life. It's gone beyond me. It's its own little piece out there. It kind of belongs to the world now.
I certainly think that what you do is magic. I have no concept, none, how any composer can write anything. I just show up and sit down and pay attention.
That's an important job, though. Don't underrate yourself. We wouldn't be here if it weren't for people
that's
like
right.
you.
So, all right. So this is all your fault. Now, you've come up with this concept. Now, how do you go out and get a commission on this? Once you've come up with this idea, What's the next step, Yolanda?
Well, you know, I was actually saying this to Jennifer yesterday, that I think my personality has always been one that I try to figure out the important thing, the big thing, which in this case was pestering Jennifer for long enough to get her to agree to do this, and then I figure out all the details later. You know, I think you can get very bogged down with details until you nail down the central concept or the big shot. And so, you know, I guess I pestered you for a long time, and once I finally got you to say, yeah, I think I can do this for this season, then I started gathering, you know, and there are many forces involved in, you know, just supporting it, presenting it, financing, you know, a big operation like this with so many different orchestras and such an illustrious composer, that, you know, I just kind of tried to take one piece of the equation at a time and assemble it. And of course, Ward was so lovely and open to the idea as well of being the premiering orchestra, which, oh, you know, is an important thing.
He would say no?
Well, it's always an option.
Never. You can't say no to Yolanda.
Oh, you can't say no to Jennifer.
Or Jennifer.
That's right.
When they're together, it's over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Your fate has been laid.
It's a good match, I think, though. It really, it's good. And, you know, any piece that gets premiered can go under really fast if not all mm-hmm. the people on board are on board. Mm-hmm. It can really be disaster fairly quickly.
So you said that you wrote a lot of harp, included a lot of harp on your build up to the actual creation of this harp concerto. So going into this, Jennifer, what was your starting point? What did you think when you thought of the harp?
You know, I actually started thinking more after looking at the repertoire and meeting. Yolanda came down to Philadelphia and played music for me, and we talked a lot about the instrument. And I thought about what would make a piece work for a harpist to be able to take around. And one of the things I wanted to do was to prove that the harp can actually rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, it's not just beautiful lyrical. It is beautiful lyrical. It's completely exquisite. But I also wanted kind of an element in there that would, even if it was someone coming into a concert hall for the very first time who had never been to a classical concert, I wanted them to be entranced enough to say, oh, I got to go back and hear that again, or I've got to go back in and see what else this orchestra mm-hmm. is doing. So when I'm writing, I'm often thinking, how can I write this to speak to someone who's walking into the hall for the first time? I don't think you should have to have a doctorate to mm-hmm. understand the music. And to me, my response to a lot of pieces is always an emotional one. That's first and foremost. So I always take it from an emotional viewpoint. Mm-hmm. So you kind of break it down. You ask your soloist, what would you like in the piece? What works well on the instrument? What doesn't work well on the instrument? And for the harp in particular, there are more limitations than, say, a violin concerto. Mm-hmm.
And I think I do remember asking you at one point, you know, could you give me a groove? I really want to be able to really get into a rhythmic, sort of assertive groove, because that's the kind of music I love the more lyrical playing as well. But, you know, I feel like, going back to my roots as a harpist, it was my mom's idea to play the harp in the first place, not mine at all, because I grew up in Oklahoma, and I was growing up a little bit of a tomboy, and I'm quite certain she thought the harp would refine me. And so she...
Did it?
No, in fact... In fact, I often say that I think instead of me becoming a little more angelic with the harp, I think perhaps over the course of my career, the harp has become just slightly less angelic with me at it.
The harp is a percussive instrument.
It is.
It's not all this glissando.
It can be powerful, and, you know, I'm kind of... an advocate of playing against type with the instrument a little bit. Jennifer has me doing all kinds of cool stuff. You know, I like playing fortissimo. I like banging on the soundboard. I like doing rhythmic treatment of glissandos, which are, you know, the big ethereal sound on the instrument. And I like being able to use them in a rhythmic way, not just a dream sequence, you know, floating to heaven kind of a way.
So I know. So what do you else do you like about this? I assume you actually like this concerto. Don't take that question wrong.
I won't. It's a legitimate question, but actually. I find, you know, it's a big thing to tailor a concerto for a performer. And so you want it to resonate. And you realize there's always the chance that you may write the thing. And it just may not quite do it. So, and I always think a composer should push the boundary of the instrument just a little bit. Mm-hmm. Because that's the way music moves forward. Someone's always pushing the boundary just mm-hmm. a little bit. The players are really good. They figure out if they can do it. They figure out what has to be adjusted. And then the next group comes along, the next generation, and they're like, okay. So they're doing it, and they're making it look easier. Mm-hmm. You're like, wow, how did that happen? So
you like it, Yolanda?
I do. I really, really love it. And in fact, you know, one of the first times I really sat down, but in February, and was really fleshing it out, and putting fingerings and pedalings, and you know, really making the part my own roadmap. I remember texting Jennifer, you know, pretty immediately, and saying, "Jennifer, this is the first time I've ever sat down with a brand new piece of contemporary music and talk to myself in language that is appropriate for my daughter to overhear." usually it's a bit of a, you know, one of those thought bubbles of, you right. know, star sign and asterisk and hashtag and all that stuff. But I was just, you know, I found myself saying, God, you know, she really understands. We use four fingers in each hand, and I can't get from the bottom of the harp to the top of the harp in, you know, 0.2 seconds. And, you know, she gets it. So I'm so grateful, really grateful for this.
So this week we are going to hear the premiere of this, and you have, like, the touchstone performance. This is it. Mm-hmm. This is what everyone's going to refer to from this moment on. How's that feel?
Well, now that you put it that way. You know what I think? I try really hard, you know, I've premiered a lot of pieces, you know, I've premiered a couple of harp concertos, a lot of chamber music, a handful of solo works for the harp as well. And, you know, each time I do that, I try to really remind myself that it really is a process. You know, like Jennifer was saying, you know, yesterday's rehearsal, I felt like, you know, I was just trying to let all the sound and all the colors kind of swirl around me, and there's like a bit of an absorption process where you don't quite know what's going on. And that would certainly, you know, describe how I felt yesterday. And then, you know, today it was sort of like the planets start to align, and, you know, you've never heard any of this before. And so it's completely new to you. And I think the goal in doing a first performance should be just to try and absorb and let as much assembly of musical parts make sense by the time you take it out there for an audience, and then just try and have a little fun with it. It's not going to be what it will be, you know, at the end of this premiere series, you know, which I think is so great. What you know, we do with these consortiums where many different orchestras get to play the piece, and you get to take it to a lot of different communities and introduce it. And I think, you know, that's part of the process of playing in a new work as well. But I'm really excited for tomorrow night, and then I'm so excited to come back in September and do it again. By then I'll have played it two more times in addition to this week in Rochester. So I just try and remember that it's a process. It's, you roll up your sleeves. And
you know what, that's actually, I had never thought about describing it, because it exists in my head, and the first time I hear it with the orchestra, I always step back, because constantly every new piece starts out as a giant fuzzy picture. Because the orchestra is also trying to figure out what's going on. They're trying to figure out who's playing when. Are they in the right spot? Are they with someone? Or are they solo? Mm-hmm. So it's a fuzzy picture that slowly comes into focus. And so what happens is, by the time you get to the premiere, it's getting close to being in focus. But like when you do Brahms 2, I guarantee you, when that piece was premiered, it probably sounded really not so good, especially compared to what it sounds like now. Every piece sounds rough when it first goes out, and it gets more and more in focus with each performance. Even I've discovered when the piece moves to other musicians, even though they may not have heard it, it's almost like the piece existing in the world seems to have some sort of I don't know what it is, almost like a universal kind of wave thing that goes on.
It's part of that magic.
It is part of the magic, and it's very real. For me, it's amazing because I get to watch the piece kind of become a very focused picture. And I'm probably the only one who gets that because I know what the original sounds like, and then I see it kind of coming into focus. So it's an interesting perspective.
Is this done, or are you making adjustments?
Oh, I'm making adjustments. Even now I'm looking at it saying, all right, do I need to adjust? We were adjusting in rehearsal today, you know, kind of thinning some things down. I've got probably 40 spots marked to pull dynamics down. Yolanda and I are both talking about, like, can we adjust the harp part here? We change the rhythms? Because you want it to be something that will work for everybody. Even though my music's pretty hard, so this is the interesting challenge. I want to make sure there's nothing that's so extreme that it basically excludes every human being on the planet from even being able to do it. So you try to figure out, and I'm not a harpist, so I have to talk to the expert on this. Same for talking, really, to any conductor who's handling something like this, because they are standing, they're in the firing line. They're in front of all those musicians, and the conductor can tell you a lot about what is working, what's not working.
And that is a voice we haven't heard from yet about this piece, and that's yours, Ward. What do you think?
Well, I love it, and I couldn't be more happy with, you know, as you said, the way things worked out this week. I mean, we're having a ball, I think. It's and the orchestra, too. That I have to say, I'm always proud of my orchestra, of course, for many reasons. But I think they really enjoy the premiere process. You know, we've done it a couple times now, and, you know, they come ready to go, you know, eager to have the input from the composer and the soloist. And, you know, it was great. The first rehearsal, Jennifer sat literally right behind me and Yolanda, and, you know, we would finish a passage and just turn around and touch base about it. And, you know, the orchestra would ask some questions directly to her. I mean, can you imagine having Brahms, you know, there when you're rehearsing the Second Symphony? It's so cool.
He was very cranky. I'm not sure.
Jennifer has a much better personality, I have to say. Not that I knew Brahms, but everything I've read. But, no, I think... it's just great, and I really had the easiest part of this whole process because, you know, obviously you did all the heavy lifting making it happen. You created this amazing work, and so I've really been just, you know, sitting back. I have the easy part, I think, this week and throughout the process, but I'll never forget the first day, you know, that I sat down to open the page for the first time. I was so excited, and I was surprised, and I don't mean surprised because I didn't expect it would be great. I just, you know, I didn't think of a harp concerto in this way, which is what, you know, and I just think it's brilliant the way Jennifer has combined. It's in four movements, and each movement is so different. It has such a different atmosphere, such a different personality. I mean, it really rocks out and grooves at the end in the fourth movement, like Yolanda was saying. But then, you know, we have these full-throated, really vibrant passages for the whole orchestra where it's just, you know, so much energy. And then, you know, the third movement is all solo winds and one string player. You know, there's one violin, one viola, one cello, one bass. It's so intimate and delicate and beautiful. And I just think when I was looking through it, I thought, wow, what a range. I mean, just amazing. My hat's off to you, Jennifer.
Oh, well,
because
thank you.
It's so imaginative, and I think it showcases the harp in such a virtuosic way, but it's also just great music, and I think people are really going to respond to it, and I've loved, it's been an honor to work on it.
You know, I think that one of the things about Jennifer's music is her beautiful use of winds. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about you as if you're not here.
That's okay, I totally understand. Sometimes they forget I'm in the room, that's fine.
So I'm really pleased to hear that there's a whole movement that does that uses the winds. One of the toughest things, and you will both, Yolanda and Jennifer, know this, is that balance between the harp and the orchestra. This is also the same problem guitarists have, of how do you balance this somewhat quiet instrument? I mean,
yesterday I think we moved the harp, what, four times?
Yeah.
Our poor stage crew this week.
Yeah, and just to find, you know, the spot where, you know, for this, and no offense, Ward, but usually when I play concertos, I sit way out front and I look up once a page just to check it.
Just to check it.
To make funny faces or something.
Right.
And you know, but this one we really kind of discovered that I really couldn't do that. I really needed to see Ward. And, you know, in the process of putting things all together with a brand new piece. So, you know, we had to find the spot that worked acoustically and then also one that, you know, was practically feasible with that. But, you know, I also think, you know, I was just thinking today, I practiced some after the rehearsal, and for whatever reason, this beautiful third movement that Ward was just mentioning, that is really like a chamber music on a big scale, on a big stage. And you know, what is so cool about this process that just makes me feel so grateful I get to be, you know, a part of this, is for some reason I've just been thinking and conceptualizing that movement, that slower movement, slower than Jennifer wrote it. And I would sort of lapse into my, you know, kind of luxurious, spacious tempo, and you know, it's so fabulous to have the composer right here say, you know, that is just painfully slow. That needs to go faster. And not sort of, you know, just kind of rest into what may feel just instantly, oh, you know, that's how it should go. And then working on it after the rehearsal, it's like you get this light bulb that is, you know, basically flicked on by the composer, who is right there with you. And I realized, you know, this movement really should not be so slow. And, you know, it's got this lightness, this effervescence that, you know, the slowness kind of just stomps out. So it's so cool to, like, you know, have that kind of access to a composer and get their concept rather than your interpretive concept that you lay over what, you know, may be there.
Well, this is obviously a great working relationship. However, I can't imagine that in your career as a composer there hasn't been a moment where you said, you know, that really should be going faster, and they say no.
There have been moments, actually. Usually my tempo markings are a little too hot, and normally we have to pull it down. But I've also learned through the years, from having enough pieces go to enough halls, that you also play, especially with the orchestra, you play the hall. Mm-hmm. Because there have been times where I've had pieces done where there was a 7-second reverb, mm-hmm. which is it's been like in an old train station in Paris, mm-hmm. and that's very different than being in a dry space. So right. I also learned to respect the musicians. They find a groove for something as well. But I also know how the whole thing is assembled, so I can tell when something's being compromised for maybe one section of the orchestra, because we're not at the speed where maybe the bows need to bounce or something. Mm-hmm. I'm totally aware that tempo is very specific to each section of the orchestra. Most people don't realize that. But I think mm-hmm. writing a tuba concerto and a little brass concerto this year really showed me that, because those folks have to breathe and they cannot play all the time. I became much more hyper aware of each section has different demands, especially mm-hmm. in a concerto. You have to figure out how to get all this stuff to fit together. And we do it in a small amount of rehearsal. I think people mm-hmm. would be pretty amazed. It says something about the skill of this orchestra. It's just fantastic that we can assemble this piece in a small amount of time. And it's pretty complex. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are a lot of moving parts, and nobody has kind of a small part. I mean, even the people in the orchestra end up playing a lot more, I think, in my concertos than they do in standard.
Oh, yeah.
Concertos. Mm-hmm. Like the percussionists were thanking me today mm-hmm. for giving them, they said, for interesting parts that are very engaging. They're having a lot of fun back there. Mm-hmm. And they're great, because the musicians have been talking to me about, you know, this might work better with this, or that might, this crotality might work better than the one we were thinking about, and perhaps a harder mallet here. So I'm having these great conversations mm-hmm. with the people in the ensemble. And in essence, they're making the history of this piece mm-hmm. because they're helping me make decisions that will become a permanent part of the piece. And that's an amazing mm-hmm. thing. I mean, Brahms and Beethoven, can you imagine what it would have been like for them if they could have had more conversations with mm-hmm. their musicians? But musicians now are so good. Mm. They're so much better than they were in the earlier days of classical music, that they can do so much more. And that makes my job even more thrilling, because then I can kind of daydream cool sounds. Strangely enough, sometimes it's that simple. I'm like, what would be a cool sound here?
Well, what's also so great about you, though, is you listen to the people you're writing for. And that, I think, you know, I've enjoyed working with a lot of composers, but I have to say, you know, you're just so fully open, you know, and that makes a big difference, because, you know, instrumentalists, we've got a lot going on. We got to figure out how to make all this stuff work. And I think when you're working with a composer who, you know, just has this married to this vision, whether or not it even falls remotely in the idiom, is really tough, and it can be a little bit desperation inducing sometimes. But you know, Jennifer just is really, you know, not only this fabulous artist, but she's, you know, she has a kind of a practical side too, that is what you kind of need if you want to write music that people actually can and will play.
So yes, does this have legs?
I mean, look, I don't want to jinx anything, but if I had to guess, I would say absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's one of the things that I love about Jennifer's language. It's accessible, but it's not superficial or frivolous. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's something that, like she said, you don't need a PhD to understand right away, but also there are layers to it. And, you know, every time we've gone through it, I'm discovering all these new things, and mm-hmm. I'm sure I will. It'll continue to marinate for me as well, you know, as you go to different venues and play it, and then when we come back and do it again in the fall, it's mm-hmm. going to be awesome. And I have to say, just to add on to what Yolanda was talking about, I've had situations with composers before where they were either just, you know, really hypersensitive to any criticism, and it's like you couldn't say anything to them, or they would just sit there with this goofy smile on their face, so happy that they're, you know, it's like, no, everything's great, and not give you any useful information, because, uh-huh. you know, time is valuable when you're trying to put something, and you don't want to mess yeah. around. And the thing that is just so great about the way Jennifer works with the orchestra is, you know, if something like, you know, there was a situation where the tempo just wasn't right, and she'll tell you in very definite terms, without being mean about it, mm-hmm. absolutely not, you know, no. So, okay, discussion over. Good, we have our answer. And then there are other times where we just really, you know, she's open to so mm-hmm. much. And I actually heard her at one of the breaks, she went up to one of our string players and said, is there a better way I could notate that for mm-hmm. you? And I just thought, that is so great. I mean, mm-hmm. we have a composer of your stature here with us, which is such an honor, and that you're going up to musicians and saying, how can I make this easier for you? Mm-hmm. It's just so wonderful, and that's the way it should be. So mm-hmm. thank you for that.
Listen, it helps to have really good musicians in your orchestra, too, because they can verbalize right. how they would interpret right. the symbol I'm writing mm-hmm. on their page. They're like, mm-hmm. this would probably be better if you have dots here, you know, so.
Right. Yeah. So there's a lot of learning going on. We're all learning mm-hmm. from each other, I think, which
and
is great.
And when it comes back and we chat again in September, we'll probably hear a very different piece in many ways.
Yes.
For the record.
I think
recording.
That's actually true. It'll be amazing because, mm-hmm. you know, when you're learning as a young performer, I remember my teacher telling me that you're not really going to be ready to play Bach in public until you've done it two or three times in public, and then you'll be ready.
Right, right.
So I thought, yeah, it does kind of work that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, Brahms has the benefit of being done. I'm guessing this is not the first time this orchestra has done Brahms, too. So, I mean, that kind of repeat sort mm-hmm. of experience, it kind of goes into your DNA, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, it? For sure.
Yeah, we have a piece now that, Yolanda, you get to carry in your heart for all time, and you're going to carry it on the road, and you're going to play it out there. Jennifer, you have to let it go.
Yeah, I'm okay with that because when I go to move to the next piece, I literally have to release the one I've been mm-hmm. rehearsing and working on. And I'm fortunate that I have enough projects going on that it's pretty easy because every piece is a little different. They all have different needs. They're like little children going out into the world, but you do have to kind of release them. And I'm okay with that. I totally am.
Was there ever a piece that felt hard to let go?
Oh, that's a really good question. I've had a few pieces where I had to withdraw them because they didn't work, where I took chances in the music. And I had a trombone concerto that actually I pulled a couple of years ago. And I don't think the trombonists have forgiven me since oh. they're still come up to me all the time saying, are you going to bring that back? But I work on pieces like I write 4 to 6 hours a day. So I'm really going over and over and over things, trying to make sure it works. So if I can't fix something, I pull the piece. But I really feel like once I've written it, it belongs as much to the performers and audience. It isn't just my music. It's like Blue Cathedral. That piece, I adore it, is a very personal piece for me. But it does belong to other people, and I really view it that way because music is meant to be shared. If we're not sharing it, there's not a lot of point in it being there.
You have gotten a lot of accolades, pretty darn big ones, Grammy here or there, a Pulitzer every now and then. Okay. Is there one honor that you have gotten, Jennifer, that you really think is the one?
You know what? I think actually it's the emotional response from audience members. To me, that is the one that just really is the payoff. Occasionally when someone comes up and they've got tears in their eyes and they can't speak, or they take your hands and they're like, yes, that to me that's the reward right there. That's the one I want. That's the most important one.
I want to thank you all for coming in and spending time with us today and talking about this piece, what the RPO is doing. Of course, there's Brahms, there's Britten, and there's Jennifer Higdon and Yolanda Konanassis. Thank you, Ward Stair.
Pleasure.
Yolanda Koudounassis.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's a pleasure. And Jennifer, thank you for taking time to be here well. If you'd like information about the Rochester Philharmonic season, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.